Sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on whatever happened to the family farmer. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we're talking to the police or government agents, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it, and what not to say and who not to say that to, is summed up in this maxim of law, and it says, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. He said, quote, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? He said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Now, listen to the second judge. He said, quote, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That comes from Belknap versus United States. You know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now listen to what this third judge had to say. He said, quote, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the far-sighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. There have been continuing debates over what should be the role of the federal government in preserving small, medium-sized farms in rural communities. These have waxed and waned when agricultural prices were high or low, depending upon which was which at the time. Now, over the past century, the calls for federal government intervention to preserve the family farm have been almost continuous. And indeed, numerous programs have been implemented to support farm income. And as far as stopping the decline in the numbers of family farms, they have totally failed. Many programs appear to have just the opposite effect. A large proportion of the price support has gone to a relatively few, very large-scale corporate farm operations. These have continued to expand using these government funds to get bigger and bigger. Large corporate farms are far ahead in financing and technology. Large operations have the capital to obtain new technology and can afford to take risks that smaller farming operations simply cannot afford to take. In recent years, the voices calling for a return to the family farms have become more muted. And in the last presidential election, agriculture and the family farm were not major issues for discussion. And this is probably closely related to the major decline in the voting power of farmers. I believe that the numbers of mid-sized family farms will continue to decline until they become vestiges of the past. And any unbiased observer might say that they already are vestiges compared to those of 1900. Perhaps they will become the Currier and Ives stereotypes for the future. Children of tomorrow will go to living history farms to see what farming was like in the past. Well, I don't like to make that statement about the continued decline of family farms, but unfortunately I believe that it's true. My family farm background biases me in favor of family farms, but this is not enough to offset the hard facts of what we see occurring around us every day. I've been watching the demise of small grocery stores, small hardware stores, and many other small retail businesses. Do small businesses not have equal rights to survive? Small businesses are often called the backbone of our country. If so, we should do more to enable them to survive. And as consumers, we have benefited from the growth of these large-scale retailers and farm operations. We get cheaper food and other products, but we do so at a very severe cost to the small retailers and the small family farmers who are and have been forced out of business. In the Agricultural Examiner for July 23, 2004, A.V. Krebs put an article in here called The Commentary on the USDA Incorporated. It's a 40-page report that documents, from the perspective of the USDA and the farming industry, the decline of the small family farm. In reading USDA Incorporated, which is about how agribusiness has hijacked the regulatory policy at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's a paper written by Philip Matera, a paper which was released today, one is reminded of author Studs Terkel's axiom, which said, we can't know where we're going if we don't know where we've been. Well, this 40-page paper, which was conceived by the Organization for Competitive Markets and commissioned by a working group of Agribusiness Accountability Initiative, it sadly ignored that axiom in this report, and thus it operates in the historical vacuum that leads the reader to believe that the USDA and their selling out of Americans' family farmers is simply a recent phenomenon. Well, at the very outset, the author, who is a director of the corporate research product of Good Jobs, or project rather of Good Jobs, first exhibits a confusion in seeking to explain his rather unwieldy term, Agribusiness Industries Department, in the context of describing the United States Department of Agriculture's role in agribusiness. As an observer, I have come to the conclusion that the USDA is simply a tool of Archer Daniels Midland Corporation and Cargill Tyson Foods, and that the objective is to destroy the small family farm. After all, they're competitors, aren't they? Why would ADM want to compete against some guy with 300 cows or 200 acres of corn if we could drive him out of business and take over his farming operation? ADM then would have one less competitor, wouldn't they? This whole argument over preserving, protecting, and giving the small family farmer a good shake has been nothing more than a government ploy to destroy the small family American farmer. It's worked like a shot. They began back in 1922. It fits in with the ninth plank to the Communist Manifesto. I'll come to that in a little bit when we talk about these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, but just for the purposes of our discussion here, in 1920, the population of the United States was about 100 million people. And about half of those people, some 45 million of them, lived out on the farm. Now, the objective here was to move all of these farmers, these independent people, half the population of America nearly, from the farm into the city, put them to work in the military-industrial complex. They've done that. Because between 1920 and 1940, in that 20-year period, the population of rural America dropped from 45 million to 32 million. Think of that, 45 million to 32 million in 20 years. Then from 1940 to 1950, the population dropped again from 32 million to 15 million. Then from 1950 to 1969, the population in rural America living on the farm dropped from 15 million to 6 million. It dropped again from 1969 until today. The population has dropped to 1.9 million. We now have more people locked up in our jails and prisons than we have out on the farms producing food and fiber. 50% of our food, that is 50% of the food that we eat here in the United States, not the food that we're exporting, but 50% of the food that we're eating, you know, the tomatoes, peppers, garlics, meat, milk, butter, and eggs, is being imported from outside of our borders. That's 50%. America is still a net exporter of grains, but by the year 2008, we will be a net importer of grain. Something very dramatic has occurred here in America. Something that is so dramatic that we have to go back to the Bible. In fact, we have to go back to Genesis chapter 47, verses 13 through 26, to see a parallel of such a massive removal of people from the land to the cities, from total independence to total dependence upon the government. It occurred about 1800 BC. It occurred in ancient Egypt, when the bulk of the population out on the farms were divested of all of their property, removed to the cities from the one end of Egypt to the other, reduced from independence to total dependence upon the government. If you've got a Bible, why don't you take a look at that, Genesis 47, verses 13 through 26. And then we'll take a look at the Roosevelt New Deal from 1933 through 1945. In fact, we'll take a look at the socialization of America from the 1930s to today, through the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. All 10 planks, and I'll take you through and I'll show you that the socialization and the communization of America is a product of the Roosevelt New Deal and the New World Order. It was planned that way. And it was planned that way, and it's been executed by God Almighty himself in two chapters of the scripture, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, which are the two penal clause chapters. Penal clause chapters, that's right. When you have a contract, you have to have a penal clause, and the old covenants that our people, the Israelites, negotiated with God Almighty out at Mount Sinai through Moses had a penal clause. It had 33 articulable benefits and 107 penalties that were determined by God Almighty and written up in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And you can read those for yourself. We'll cover those as we progress through this series of what happened to the American farmer. We'll be right back with more right after this. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when I'm asked who would I recommend for a lawyer, I always recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Now, if you can't afford Spence, my second choice would be you. That's right. That's because you're the best person to represent your own interests in court. After all, you were there. And you know whether or not you did it, because you either did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know who the witnesses are. You know what was said. You know who said it. You know who's lying, and you know who's telling the truth. You know. But you know your lawyer doesn't know any more about your case than you can tell him. And besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. But representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and three rules, and that is, don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Well, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call me at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it, would you? That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, when we took our break, so get your Bible out and let's take a look at the biggest land transaction in the history of the world up to that time, about 1800 BC, occurred in Egypt. A bigger transfer of land and ownership of property occurred in the United States from the 1930s through the 1940s, and I'll show you that when we get to it. But right here, in verse 13, chapter 47 of Genesis, it says, "And there was no bread in all of the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all of the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all of the Egyptians came to Joseph, and they said, 'Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? Because the money has failed.' So Joseph said, 'Will you give me your cattle? And I'll give you your cattle if money fails.' So they brought their cattle to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for flocks and for their cattle of their herds and for their asses, and he fed them with bread for all of their cattle for that year. And when the year was ended, they came to him the second year, and they said to him, 'Well, we will not hide it from our Lord, how that our money is spent. My Lord also has our herds of cattle. There is aught left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread. And we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate.' And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them, so the land of Egypt became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to cities from the one end of the borders of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not. For the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and they did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them. Wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said unto the people, 'Behold, I have bought you this day, and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase that you shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for the food, and for them of your households, and for food for your little ones.' And the people said, 'You have saved our lives. Let us find grace in thy sight, in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants.' And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's." Well, in 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt did the exact same thing to the people of America, and particularly he zeroed in on the farmers, because remember, the farmers represented about half the population in the nation in 1920. By 1930, it was down somewhat. But because of the Great Depression, Farmers were leaving the farms by the tens of thousands, in fact, by the millions, moving to California to get out of the Dust Bowl. They couldn't make a living. The Great Depression had brought an economic collapse to agriculture in the United States. Now, here's what Franklin D. Roosevelt did, and the following is taken from the Book of Roosevelt, chapter 47, verses 13 through 26. And there was no money in all the land, for the Great Depression was very sore, so that the land of America and all of the several states fainted by reason of the Great Depression. And Franklin D. Roosevelt gathered up all the gold that was in the land of America and in the several states for the Federal Reserve notes, which they bought under House Joint Resolution 192, and Franklin D. Roosevelt brought the gold into Fort Knox for the Federal Reserve banks. And when the economy failed in the land of America and in the several states, all of the Americans came unto FDR and said, "Give us credit, for why should we suffer in thy presence, for the economy faileth?" And FDR said, "Mortgage your properties, and the government will give you credit if the economy faileth." So the people mortgaged their property under the government, and FDR gave them credit in exchange for houses and for the farms and for the businesses and for all of the properties, and he gave them credit for their property for that year. And when the year was ended, they came unto him the second year, and they said unto him, "We will not hide it from our president how that our credit is spent. Our government also has our houses and our businesses and all of our properties, and there is aught left in the sight of our government but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we suffer before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for credit, and we and our land will be servants unto the United States government, and give us security that we may live and not suffer, that the nation may prosper." So FDR bought all of the land of America for the Federal Reserve Bank, for the Americans mortgaged every man his field because the Depression prevailed over them. So the land of America became the Federal Reserve Bank's land. And as for the people, he removed them to the cities under the ninth plank of the Communist Manifesto, from the one end of the borders of America even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests, the Billy Grahams, the Jerry Falwells, the Mormon Church, the Oral Roberts, and all of the incorporated churches had a portion assigned them of government under tax exemption, 501c3, and they did eat their portion which the government gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Franklin Roosevelt said unto the people, "Behold, I have bought you this day, August 15, 1935, under the Social Security Act, and your land under the Federal Land Bank Act, for the Federal Reserve Banks. And lo, here is security for you, and you shall work for the national economy. And it shall come to pass that when you receive your paychecks, that you shall give an income tax of 17% to 75% of all that you create and produce unto the government, and the rest shall be your own, for the 108 benefits given to you under the Social Security Act." And FDR said, "All you have to fear is fear itself." And the people said, "Thou hast saved us from the Great Depression. Let us find security under the government, and we will be its servants." And FDR made it a law over the land of America unto this day that the government should have an income tax of 17% to 75% of everything that the people created and produced, except, of course, the land of the priests, which came under tax exemption, 501c3. Now, you see, ladies and gentlemen, what we see going on in America today is exactly what transpired in the days of Joseph. And under the penal clause of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, the God of heaven has said, "I'm going to lean on you people. You haven't practiced my law, and you've given me the finger. And because of that, I'm going to take your benefits away from you." Now, these 33 articulable benefits are covered in the first 13 verses of Leviticus 26. In Deuteronomy 28, it's the first 14 verses. And he says, "I'm going to give you this and that and another thing." You know, he says, I'm going to have respect unto you. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, I'll give you rain in due season. The land shall yield their increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. But starting in verse 14, he says, "Now if you will not hearken unto me, and if you will not do all of these commandments, and if you shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgment so that you will not do all of my commandments, but that you break my covenants, then here's what I'm going to do to you." Now, the farmers of America don't practice land Sabbaths and jubilees. They don't practice just weights and balances. They won't practice the statutes, judgments, and commandments of God. Cattlemen, for instance, will crossbreed cattle. They will crossbreed cattle with buffalo and call them beefalo. And they make geeps out of goats and sheep. You know, it's a minor thing, but there's a statute in Leviticus 19:19 that says don't do that. Farmers in America have gone whole hog for hybrid seed, and now they're going whole hog for genetically modified organisms. And if you'll take a look at Leviticus 19:19, it tells you plainly. No, let me just read it to you. Leviticus 19:19 says, "You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind. You shall not sow your field with mingled seed, and neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon you. So the farmers mingle their seed, use genetically modified organisms. They're in violation of this Leviticus 19:19. Indeed, they're in violation of all 15. Not every farmer, but farmers as a whole, all 15 of the agricultural laws that Moses gave us out at Mount Sinai. And because of that, there's a penalty for that. And whether you believe it or not, whether you think that's true or false, you have to admit that the population of farmers on the land from 1920 to 2000 has declined from 45 million to 1,900,000. And here in Leviticus 26, verse 35-34, he says, I'll scatter you among the heathen, I'll draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities made waste. Then shall the land enjoy your Sabbaths, as long as it lies desolate, and you be in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy your Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths when you dwelled upon it. Now, you American farmers out there are going to have to admit, won't you, that you've never practiced a land Sabbath or a Jubilee. And the penalty for the violation of the Sabbath commandment is national captivity. You get expelled from the land. That's the penalty. I just read it to you. And the American farmers have been expelled from the land. And that was done to the Egyptian farmers, the Egyptian people, about 1800 B.C. And beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, you have now seen the expulsion of the American farmer from the land, pursuant to this prophecy. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we are among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution that was designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. And the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress, and not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights? Not the one who is indifferent thereto, and that's because it's a fighting clause. Its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat, and it cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor. It is valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. So says United States versus Johnson. That's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians and lawyers. Did you hear what that judge said in that statement? Your rights cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. You know, one cannot overlook the reality that agriculture has indeed become, for over a century now, simply one segment of a vast industrial complex that we call agribusiness. What needs to be of concern, or should be of immediate concern to farmers, consumers, and government officials, is the control of that vital complex by large multinational corporations. Corporations like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and Tyson and others. To be precise or imprecise in our language when it comes to identifying our real adversary, corporate agribusiness, or to use agribusiness and corporate agribusiness interchangeably, only confuses the general public. Recognizing the United States Department of Agriculture's current role in corporate agribusiness, one could justifiably argue that almost three-quarters of what the government agency does today could be turned over to the Department of Commerce, the Department of the Interior, the Food and Drug Administration, or the Environmental Protection Agency. And it's even more ironic that we read the words of Paul the Apostle in 2 Timothy 2, verse 6. It says, the husbandman that laboreth must be the first partaker of the fruits. It should be the very words that appear today over the portico of the U.S. Department of Agriculture headquarters in Washington, D.C. It's ironic because a close examination of that department's actions throughout its history reveals a bloated bureaucracy whose actions have often contributed to the demise of those very same husbandmen, America's farmers, America's family farmers, that it so proudly professes to be protecting. The reality, however, is that it has been devising and implementing various policies and programs which have had the net effect of simply enriching the coffers of corporate agribusiness at the expense of those very same small, independent family farmers that the Department of Agriculture and the United States government has been so proudly professing to be the guardians and protectors of. Now, there's 114,040 employees that work for the Department of Agriculture. There are 1.9 million farmers in America. There is one government bureaucrat in the Department of Agriculture for every 16 farmers in the nation. There's one government bureaucrat for every 16 farmers in the nation. The public school teachers are complaining because their classes have 30 students in them. Do you really think that we need a bureaucrat for every 16 farmers? Well, if one bureaucrat for every 16 farmers is good, then wouldn't one bureaucrat for every 8 farmers be twice as gooder? It kind of reminds me of the pigs of the Okefenokee. There was an old trapper up in North Dakota, and he was about 65 years old back in 1900 when this story first came to light. He'd been trapping, you know, all of his life through the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, when he was just a boy. He was born back in the 1830s. And, you know, when the Missouri River was still, you know, pristine and there was still beaver all over the Northwest, and hell, he was out there doing business with the Indians, for crying out loud, back in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. Well, it was getting on to fall up in North Dakota around October. And he'd heard about the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. There were thousands of these wild pigs. They'd gone wild down in South Georgia and Northern Florida during the Revolutionary War, or before. And they'd multiplied over the years until now there were just literally thousands of them. They're just wild and ferocious. And he'd heard about them. You know, pigs are worth about $10, $15 a piece back in 1900. And so it was, you know, it was quite a temptation to this old trapper. So he had a big Studebaker wagon and a team of big Belgian horses. So he got his stuff together, loaded in the wagon, and headed south. By about the first part of December, he pulled up to a country store in a little town on the north side of the Okefenokee Swamp down in South Georgia. He went on inside, and everybody in there could tell he was a Yankee. And they, of course, were very interested in what he was doing there and what in the world is a Yankee doing down here in South Georgia. And he told them. He said, "I came down here to trap the wild hogs of the Okefenokee." And the locals were just incredulous. And one old guy stood up there with his arm, you know, missing from the elbow down, and he said, "Well, let me show you something here, mister." He said, "You go out into that swamp, and you're liable not to come back alive." Another old guy over there had his leg missing from the knee down. He was walking around on a peg leg, and he said, "Yeah, I can testify to that. You know, you go out there into the swamp, if you can kill one of those wild hogs, you know, you're doing a big, big job. And you better have a bunch of guys out there with you watching your back. You get out there in that swamp with that team of horses and that big wagon, you get bogged down, they'll just eat your horses and eat you too. Those hogs have been wild for over 100 years. They eat acorns and snakes and roots. They're independent. They're free. They've been wild, free, and independent for 100 years or more. There's no one going out there and take the wild hogs, the free hogs from the Okefenokee." Well, the old trapper listened for a while, and he said, "Well, thank you very much, boys. I appreciate your advice, and thank you very much." And he loaded up about 5 tons of corn, 10,000 pounds, on his big wagon and headed off toward the south, toward the Okefenokee. And the locals, you know, sitting around the big potbelly stove there in the general store, down at the feed store there, they said, "That's the last you'll see of that fool. He's not coming back. You'll never see him or his horses again." Well, some time went by. 4 or 5 weeks, Christmas came on, New Year's. And right after the first of the year, the old trapper came back into town, came into the feed store, and he talked to the boys, and everybody was surprised that the guy was still alive, much less that he came back to town. I said, "Well, what are you doing? Where have you been?" He said, "Well, I've been out there around the swamp just kind of sizing it up a little bit. You know, I haven't gone out into the swamp yet. I took you boys' advice, and I'm just laying low and said I'm going to need another 10,000 pounds of corn, though." So he loaded up his wagon and ambled on out of town south toward the Okefenokee Swamp. And so another 4, 5, 6 weeks went by. About the 15th of February came along, and so he comes back into town again. And this goes on several times, you know. 15th of February, he picks up a load of corn, he goes out into the swamp, and he's gone for about 4 to 6 weeks. And then about 1st April, he comes back again, loads up another load of corn, and he hauls it down into the swamp. And this goes on. One day, about the 15th of August, he pulled into town again. And of course, the guy in the feed store said, "Well, I suppose you need about 10,000 pounds of corn again." The guy's name was Jedediah Smith. Old Jed said, "Well, Jed," I said, "I reckon you're going to need some more corn." Old Jed said, "No, sir, no. No, I don't need any corn. I need about 50 wagons, though. I got to hire a bunch of guys with about 50 wagons to go load up the hogs. I got 3,000 hogs penned up out in the big clearing in the center of the swamp." 3,000 hogs. Everybody was incredulous. People were running up down the streets. "Hey, hey, old Jed says he's got the wild hogs of the Okefenokee penned up out in the big clearing in the swamp." So people were gathered around and they wanted to know, "Well, what happened? How did you pen up those hogs out in the Okefenokee?" People just couldn't believe it. So he sat down and picked up a stick and started whittling a little bit. And he said, "Well, it's getting on toward the end of the day." He said, all you boys want to make $25 if you'll haul a load of hogs for me. I've got to have about 50 wagons. About 50 wagons. Got to haul about 50 hogs in each one. That'll be about 2,500. He said, "I got around 2,500 to 3,000 hogs. So if you got a little bigger wagon, you bring it down. We get 60, 65 hogs on there. We can probably make them all in one trip. Now we got to get them tomorrow because the hogs are hungry. The hogs out in the swamp don't have any feed. They're out of feed and they're squealing because they're hungry." And the people could hardly believe it. They said, "Why, those hogs have been free for over 100 years, eating. They've been eating snakes and roots and acorns and taking care of themselves for over 100 years. What do you mean the hogs are out there penned up and hungry, unable to feed themselves? What in the world happened that the wild hogs of the Okefenokee have become dependent, from independence to dependence, from freedom to slavery? They're penned up, and you're going to haul them off to market?" And old Jed said, "Yeah, yeah, they're all dependent. They're all hungry. They all need to be loaded up and hauled off to market. They can no longer feed themselves. They can no longer take care of themselves. They're no longer wild, and they're no longer free. I own them all. They're all penned up. And we're going out tomorrow and load them up. Stand by." All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. We're talking about whatever happened to the American farmer. You know, those who already walk submissively are going to say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. You know, the First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. You know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. You know, our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years now, have we? That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, the politicians, the lawyers, or the bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call me here at the law school, the number 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. It's free, free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. georgegordon.org. ORG, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, old Jedediah Smith sat down and said, "Well, you remember when I came here in December, y'all warned me about how wild and ferocious the pigs of the Okefenokee were, and how that I'd do well if I escaped with my life. They'd eat me and my horses. Well, I took your advice. So I didn't go out into the swamp. I just went down to the edge of the swamp, and I started putting out a little corn on the edge of the swamp. And sure enough, just like I'd figured, some of the oldest hogs and some of the youngest and dumbest hogs would actually come out of the swamp to partake of the free lunch, the free corn. And so, over a period of time, several weeks, these hogs, that is, the very young and the very old, became more and more dependent upon the corn. After all, it was a whole lot easier to come out and get that free corn than it was to root around and dig out roots and eat acorns and catch snakes. And so, over time, more and more hogs could see that the young and the old were getting the free corn, and so before long, all of the hogs were coming out of the swamp to get the free corn. And besides that, they could see that I was no threat to them, that I didn't mean them any harm, and that I was their beneficiary. or that I was their benefactor, and they were the beneficiaries of this benefactor. And after all, what's wrong with taking what's available? The corn is there, might as well take it. And they did. And after they recognized that I was no threat to them, they would let me come into the swamp. And so I came into the swamp and I fed them in the swamp, and then I went deeper and deeper into the swamp, and pretty soon I came to the big clearing in the center of the swamp. And I stopped feeding them on the outside of the swamp, and now I only fed them in the big clearing. So if they wanted to eat free corn, they had to come to me, and they had to come to the big clearing in the center of the swamp. But they could see that I was no threat to them, that I meant them no harm, that I was their benefactor. And after all, instead of going to the outside or to the outskirts or somewhere else in the swamp, they could all come to the big clearing in the center of the swamp to get the free corn. And over time, as I fed them more and more corn, they became less and less independent. Less and less did they want to root out roots and get their own acorns and catch wild snakes and feed themselves. After all, it was so much easier, and the corn tasted so much better. And I was no threat to them, and I was their benefactor. So they learned to rely less and less upon themselves, and they learned to rely more and more upon me. And so I started feeding them every other day, so that by the time I fed them, they would be very hungry, and they would squeal. And when they were hungry, they would squeal, and they would come to me and squeal. They wanted me to feed them, so every other day I would go out and I would feed them, and I'd let them get hungry, and they would come and squeal. And they learned that they had to come to me if they wanted to eat. After all, I was their benefactor, and after all, the corn was free. So once they became dependent upon my corn and dependent upon me, I started digging post holes around the perimeter of the big clearing in the center of the swamp. They could all see what I was doing, digging holes, but it was no threat. They could walk through between the holes and eat the free corn, and they were free. I was no threat to them, and they could go about their business. And then one day I started putting posts into the post holes, and I put posts all around the big clearing, and I fed them in the center of the big clearing so that they all had to go through the posts in order to get to the corn in the center of the clearing. They could see that I was no threat to them and that I was no threat to their freedom. They could come and go as they pleased. After I got all of the posts put into place, I put one rail all the way around the bottom, but I left two openings, one on each side, and the pigs could jump over the one rail. Well, some of the old ones and some of the young ones couldn't jump over the first rail, but it was no threat to them because there were two big 16-foot openings, and they could just walk through the openings. All the rest of the hogs just jumped over the one rail, went in, ate, came back, jumped over the rail, and went about their business. They could see there were posts. They could see that there was a rail, but it didn't impair their freedom. And then I put on a second rail, and then a third rail, and then a fourth rail. Pretty soon, none of the pigs could jump over the rails, but it was no threat. There were two great big openings, 16 feet, and they could come in and go out. And besides, by now, they were totally dependent upon the corn. They could not find a snake to eat. They couldn't root to get roots. They couldn't find acorns. They had no choice. They had to come to the center of the swamp, and they had to eat the corn because they were dependent upon it. But it was not a threat to their freedom. It was not a threat to them individually because there were the two big openings, and they could come and go as they pleased. Then one day I built two gates. I didn't hang the gates. I just built the two gates and leaned them up against the fence so that everybody could see that there were gates that were going to go across these two openings. Well, the pigs could see that there was a potential threat, but the gates weren't hung and the gates weren't closed. And after all, they couldn't feed themselves any longer, so they had to come in and they had to go out through the two openings. Then one day I hung both gates, but I didn't close them. I left them open, tied to the fence. The pigs went in, the pigs went out, and they did it every day, day in and day out. And they could see that I was their benefactor, and besides that, they needed the corn and they needed me. It was a partnership between me and the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. They needed me, I needed them. They ate my free corn. And then one day I closed the back gate. This caused a lot of consternation among the pigs, and they were afraid to come in and eat because they were afraid that I might close the gate, but I didn't. I left the one gate open, tied to the fence. The pigs didn't come in one day, but they got hungrier and hungrier. And some of the pigs came in, some of the pigs went out. Some of the pigs wouldn't come in, so I was patient. And as the pigs got hungrier and hungrier, they discovered that they could not live without the free corn. So they too came in. And then they came in and they went out. And they came in and they came out. And they recognized that while there was indeed two gates and one gate was closed and there was only one gate left and that there was the distinct possibility that I might close the gate, they had no choice. They were hungry. They could no longer get their own food. They could no longer take themselves. They were no longer free and independent. They were now dependent. Yesterday, all of the pigs came in and ate, and all of the pigs left. They now knew that if they wanted to eat, they had to come through that single 16-foot gate. This morning, I went in and I fed all of the hogs, and all of the hogs came in to eat. This morning, I closed the gate. And tomorrow morning, we need to go haul the wild hogs of the Okefenokee to the slaughterhouse. Now, from its inception, the USDA has, for a variety of philosophical and structural reasons, been unable to reconcile its role as a client-oriented agency of the federal government and as a major force in corporate agribusiness. With its founding in 1862, the Department of Agriculture was designed to be exclusively concerned with farmer affairs. Its comprehensive charter mandated that it acquire and diffuse among its farm constituents useful information on subjects connected with agriculture, in the most general and comprehensive sense of the word. But almost immediately, as we see in the actions of the department's second secretary, J. Sterling Morton, a trait began to emerge that would become one of the USDA's most dominant characteristics, an overly protective attitude, some would say a clear bias toward corporate agribusiness. For example, among the USDA's early functions was the procuring and the distribution of free, new, and valuable seeds and plants to the farmers. However, in 1894, in a report to Congress, Morton challenged his department's free distribution seed policy. And in light of my experience as a former seed man, however, I consider the free distribution of seeds by this department as an infringement upon the interference with a legitimate business, and I believe it should be abolished. And although Congress passed a joint resolution overruling the Secretary, corporate seed interests over the years have succeeded not only in ending the USDA's distribution of seeds, but they have radically changed the character of seed availability in general. And now we see GMOs from Monsanto and Pioneer and the FDA and the USDA in a partnership to make genetically modified seeds, to make the farmers dependent upon these new seeds, unable to take care of themselves, unable to farm, unable to provide for themselves and their families and make a profit. The USDA, in its role as the guardian of America's farmers, have taken those farmers and reduced them to dependents. And now they have taken them slave.